Hello, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Teddy Troy, and this is New Books in Public Policy. Each week, we look at a new book that is on public policy, government policy, related issues, and we talk to the author about how he came to write the book and what its implications are for our national policy. This week, we're going to be talking to Walter Olson, the author of Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia and an Overlawyered America. Olson, who is interestingly not a lawyer, has a lot to say on the subject and how our law schools influence public policy at the highest levels. I first came across the book when I was reading an excerpt of it in Commentary Magazine. My friends Bill Zeiser and David DeRozier were doing the publicity for the book, and I asked them to set me up with Mr. Olson and see if we could have a conversation. And that is what we're going to have here today. So again, this is New Books in Public Policy, and we're going to be talking to Walter Olson about his book, Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia, and an Overlawyered America. Hello, we now have Walter Olson with us. He is a scholar, a senior fellow, actually, at the Cato Institution here in Washington, previously the Manhattan Institute. And thank you for joining us on the program. I'd love to hear your thoughts on your book, but also if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, that would be great.
Okay. I'm, first of all, not a lawyer, even though I write about law. My background is in economics originally. And I've done a series of books over the years on the excesses and sometimes crazinesses of the American litigation system. And I also am pretty well known for my blog, overlawyered.com, which is often credited as being the oldest surviving blog about law.
Given that you're an economist, how did you come to start writing about the law? And your overlawyered blog is quite well known, I must say.
I was originally at a magazine called Regulation, which is now put out by Cato, but at that time was put out by the American Enterprise Institute. And it drew on a galaxy of great economists and great law professors. And I had the experience, I don't know, embarrassing or otherwise, of finding that I was fascinated by what the law professors had to say. It was a whole new world which I was drawn to, and I actually wanted to write more about that than about the economic issues that I came in on.
You know, I first came across your book, although I've been familiar with your work for a long time, but I came across your book by reading the excerpt that you had in Commentary Magazine, and I really couldn't put it down. It was fascinating. You talked about the single perspective that there is at the law schools. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that single perspective is, why it exists, why law schools are the way they are, and what are the implications of that sort of single perspective?
There is a sort of consensus, comfortable view that pervades the legal professoriate, and it is generally a liberal left kind of point of view. One of the anecdotes that I tell is Harold Coe, the dean of Yale Law School, now in the Obama administration in the State Department, was greeting the entering class, and he said, welcome entering class of 2000, whatever it is, welcome to the Republic of Conscience. Welcome to Yale Law School. And that phrase caught me up dead, Republic of Conscience. I don't know whether it's more funny, more pretentious, more open-ended or what, but it was as if getting a ticket into Yale Law School was somehow a sign that you had a finer, purer conscience than people who were going to medical school or engineering school or out to work for a living. And I thought that needed to be challenged. I also thought that it tied in with what I mentioned as the comfortable political consensus, where you really can, you know, to reduce it to liberal, conservative, or Republican, Democrat terms, it's not unusual to find an 8-to-1, 10-to-1 ratio. And this is pretty well documented. The New York Times had a good article on it. There may be one, there may be two outspoken libertarians or conservatives, but in general, it's very easy to get through law school, you know, or as a student, or perhaps even as a professor, and never find any particular challenge or pushback to the comfortable liberal assumptions that you bring.
Yeah, you mentioned that there is sort of this one perspective, but it's interesting that the Supreme Court of the United States right now, every member of the Supreme Court, if I'm correct, has gone to either Harvard Law School or Yale Law School, even though I know Ruth Bader Ginsburg went to Cornell, I believe, for a time, but all of them went to Harvard or Yale for at least some period of their law school career, and there is a majority of conservatives on the Supreme Court. How do you account for that?
Well, for that to happen, Republican presidents had to be engaged in a very artificial selection process in which they picked people who were, I once put it, at war with the ethos of the institutions that they emerged from. And certainly you can see with Nino Scalia that although he is of the Legal Academy and he was a very distinguished law professor, he was almost alone. He was so far on a limb pursuing his ideas. And that has been the general manner of selection, if I may say so, for more than one Republican president, which is find someone who and will come in for an interview, and when you ask them about the state of legal academia, they will get make it emphatic that they are at odds with it. That's how we got 4.5 or 5 conservatives on the Supreme Court, and we certainly wouldn't have gotten it by picking randomly from Yale and Harvard professors or even students.
Yeah, obviously I know what you mean by 4.5 justices or a conservative on the Supreme Court, but perhaps you can explain it to the listeners.
Well, it may be unfair to Justice Kennedy, as it might have been unfair to Justice O'Connor before him, to treat them as half a justice. Of course, he is a complete justice. It's just that his instincts are only about half conservative, and that means that he is often left as a swing vote, keeping the court conservative on certain issues, giving liberals victories on many others.
Yeah, it seems to me kind of interesting that whether you're liberal or conservative, when you are picking a Supreme Court justice, it's almost mandatory these days that you must pick from Harvard or Yale or one of those schools. In fact, when President Bush tried to pick someone who was not from one of the elite schools, I'm talking about Harriet Myers, the cacophony of assaults from the right, as well as, well, the left was a little quieter about it, but the right was certainly brutal in their assaults against her because she was not from one of these elite schools that they purport to hate. What's going on there?
Well, there was more going on with the Myers nomination, so I would not reduce it to just the elite versus non-elite thing. But what you're getting at more broadly certainly is a remarkable thing about legal academia, which is the status stratification is just extraordinary, and especially when you bear in mind that these are institutions that make a big to-do about egalitarianism. I mean, that no one talks a better game as far as inclusiveness and the need to overcome class and status, the dead hands of the past and so forth. And then when you look at how they rate applicants, potential faculty, almost anything, you will find that there is this ultra-sensitive, exquisite differentiation between the number 11 and the number 13 institution. I say that, I've looked at the hereditary aristocracy of England, and I still don't think that they are as aware of rank and title as American law schools are. And this is not inevitable. It's not just the way academia has to be. One of the driving forces, of course, is U.S. news rankings and the like. But if you look at an area like medical education, which where the stakes are really just as high, studies have found that the perceived status of the medical school that a doctor went to just is not as all important in determining their later career arc. And in the case of law schools, most places will hire professors only from a very, very few institutions. You need to have gone to Yale, Harvard, Chicago, maybe a couple of others. Many of the top firms simply will not recruit below a certain level and so forth. And so that for the legal profession, this means that the Harvard and Yale brands are extraordinarily important brands.
Yeah, I would take slight issue with one thing you said, which is medical education is perhaps as important as legal education. I would say given that it's life and death, it might be more important. But let me ask another question in terms of the book. You have a character in there who is not a famous person by any means, but you'd say he's hugely important. Who is William Prosser, and why is he important?
Well, the career of William Prosser is a good example of how people who really are not known at all outside the legal academy can have had more impact on American history than many famous public figures that we could name. And Prosser was a professor at several law schools. He wound up as dean at Berkeley Bolt Hall in California. And he was the author of Prosser on Torts, which is the standard book that lawyers learned tort law out of for decades. And he's the author also of several very influential law review articles. And he was then, even then, and certainly now, almost entirely unknown to non-lawyers. But because he had strong views, which he put in a persuasive way, about the need for tort law to expand, that Prosser was generally in favor of having tort law do much, much more than it had been expected to do earlier in American history. It was, some people thought that he saw it as a kind of surrogate social insurance, even if you didn't go that far. He certainly believed that it should be compensating many more accidents and paying for more pain and suffering and letting you sue more people over them and so forth. And these views were presented in a pedagogical context. People absorbed them in the casebooks. And they seemed natural and normal to a generation or two of lawyers who graduated. And bit by bit, and it did take quite a few years, the courts began adopting Prosser's theories, and we got what is colloquially called the litigation explosion. The tort law in America began liberalizing to an extent that had never been seen in any country ever. And we grew a section of our legal system having to do with accidents and injuries that was several times the size of the comparable sector in other advanced economies.
Yeah, you had a better phrase for it, or an additional phrase for it. You called it the American disease.
That's not my phrase. A phrase that often occurs when non-Americans are writing about, not wanting their country to catch the American disease, which is lawyers invading everything, taking their one-third fee and whole sectors of endeavor being slowed down, if not paralyzed, by people's fear of being sued. That is very much something that is correctly perceived as a special American problem. It is something that does not afflict our industrial competitors to anywhere near the extent. And if you're looking for why, and there's a lot of theories you can offer, and in my earlier books I do, but so underrated as a reason is that our legal academia, not just Prosser, but another dozen professors that we could talk about, were of the mind that they thought litigation was generally a grand thing that should be encouraged. If we have the strangeness of a hostile environment law, where telling a joke from last night's Seinfeld can result in a complaint that you're engaged in sexual harassment. You can trace back the theory of hostile environment and of people being harassed by third parties over jokes told to fourth parties, and you will find Professor Catherine McKinnon. She invented a lot of the substance of that law, more or less from scratch. And so, for better or worse, and we could find cases where I like the results, but it's a whole influence on American policy and law that lawyers know about and the general public doesn't focus on very much.
You mentioned this joke from Seinfeld. Is that a real case? And what was the joke in question?
Well, you're not going to get me to repeat that joke and open us all up to liability, are you? But it was a joke, maybe a somewhat off-color joke, although since it was told on primetime TV, there's a limit as to how off-color it might be. But the guy, I believe this was a lawsuit in Wisconsin, he came in and told it, basically around the water cooler. And the question that arose in the subsequent litigation was, is an employer legally expected to cleanse the atmosphere at work from the sort of junk that everyone is exposed to if they flip on their TV during prime time? And it sounds paradoxical when you put it that way, because you'd think that anything that you could say on the radio or on TV, you of course could say in the office, but paradoxical or not, that's not at all the way we've set it up. You can say all sorts of things on the airwaves that would get you or your employer in legal trouble if someone chose to file a complaint as well.
Yeah, the listeners to this podcast are pretty tech savvy, so I would urge them, if they are interested in the joke, to look up Seinfeld joke lawsuit, and you will probably find it on Google. Now, Google has other dangers, and when I was reading your book, you talk about a mysterious Professor A who did not like evaluations that he got in the classroom, which are not very positive, and it had some real implications for legal policy and for law schools in general. I did a quick Google search, and I pretty quickly figured out that you're talking about a Professor Abel. I don't know why the mystery. I'd love to hear why you chose to disguise the professor's name and what was the meaning of his article on evaluations.
Well, I was critical in ways that inevitably might seem hurtful because he was writing about his own evaluations, many of which were very negative evaluations.
Which he chose to highlight.
Right? Well, that was the thing. I mean, he chose to do a big law review article about are student evaluations unfair? Why, look here at mine. You know, mine are terribly unfair because people keep saying that I've politicized the classroom and, they don't realize that this is, law is inherently political and so forth and so on. Now,
and he had politicized the classroom, as you show
in
the book.
There's so much that I disagree with in his position, but at the same time, if you believe that he comes off looking in a very unflattering light, I thought that it might be perceived as piling on to also tell everyone his name. And they certainly could get the point of the episode from what I did give them.
So why was the episode important, and why did his paper cause a stir, and what were the implications of that?
Well, I had wondered, and I think a lot of people have wondered, when students do evaluations, does it make a difference? That is, some teachers are much liked by students and recommended to each other. You know, whatever you do, don't miss their class. Other teachers get very poor evaluations. And you can see this directly if you go to one of the websites where students evaluate their professors for the whole world to see, and there are such websites. You don't get as good a view usually, although this was an exception, of the internal ones that are submitted to the university administration. So the question is, how much weight do the schools put on teaching in general, and to the extent that evaluations are one clue in distinguishing the great from the not-so-great, how much weight do they give on that? So here was an article, which is, as I said, been widely cited by a guy who admittedly was acting from a sense of grievance of, have my evaluations been unfair, and specifically are unfair evaluations shooting down the careers of professors like me because their students are complaining that they're too political. He went out trying to prove or disprove that, and he certainly wasn't predisposed to believe that people survived with flying colors despite bad evaluations, but that is kind of what he found. He surveyed these law schools, and he found that most of them placed zero weight on student evaluations, presumably even with very extreme results. They placed zero weight on the difference between the one who got all raves and the one who got all pounds, and the few that took into account placed very little weight on it. And so he concluded, perhaps against what he initially expected to find, that professors' careers were not being harmed by the fact that their students were in almost open revolt in the evaluation system.
So it doesn't matter what they say in the classrooms, but there are ways by which professors are selected. And I think you talk about in the chapter, there's excerpts and commentary, how difficult it is for a conservative to get a position at a law school. In what ways do they prevent certain ideologies from making it onto campus and others they encourage?
Well, the Legal Academy is a club in which you are voted in by existing members of the club. And the results are pretty much as you would expect, which is that there is some conscious bias. There is a lot more that is does not necessarily rise to the level of, I'm going to kick that one out from consideration because I don't like his politics. The shared presumptions, the comfort levels, are often the most important thing that's going on. You see a stack of resumes, and you notice, that one's mentor is someone that I know and I've interacted with. You know, this other one's mentor, who is that exactly? I've never read any of her articles. And, you know, this one is working in a subject area why I know 10 people also thrilled about that subject area who want to, there'd be a lot more legal scholarship on it than this other one. So you wind up, I do think that's a lot of where it begins. The conservatives they'll have different mentors. They will be producing work in different areas that may not seem as interesting, or you may not see its point if you disagree politically. And beyond that, you've got a bunch of different pressures on the schools. You've got the fact that the accreditation agencies and some of the funders and various others are pressing them to do more identity politics studies. That is just a fact of life in the accreditation world, and it means that if there are new jobs, often they will go to the person who can extend your diversity program in a particular direction, and that it better not be someone who's going to fall into the diversity category but then do a completely different kind of scholarly work. Or, I mean, some schools can put up with that. Other schools say, you know, look, if we're hiring you is because we have no presence in, you know, Hispanic-oriented law, we don't want you writing about bankruptcy or some topic that, you know, has no race or ethnic or gender content. So you have a bunch of different pressures. One of them is the somewhat artificially forced growth of clinical law. Clinical law is the section of a law school that goes out and files real-world lawsuits as an educational enterprise, and it's much more overwhelmingly left in its general leanings than some other parts of the law school are. Again, if you add up the different specialties, you will find, and there are good numbers on here from someone who would normally disagree with me on almost everything, a professor at the University of Chicago who has toted up, simply by citation counts, who are the most cited and therefore probably among the most influential law professors in various specialties. And what he found, certainly very consistent with what I would say, is that where you find more political balance, or at least a significant number of people to the right of center, is in a short list of mostly economically oriented topics, like securities law, antitrust law, and economics. There you can find a real ideological debate. I mean, plenty of liberals and plenty of apolitical people in both of those areas, or in all of those areas. But there is at least a real political spectrum. Move over to areas like constitutional law, labor and employment, environmental law, international law, procedure, and it's not uncommon to have the first dozen positions in constitutional law, for example. You know, it's pretty much all outspoken liberals, and there are no outspoken conservatives in them. It's just the way that constitutional law is, and that's, you know, I think you'll see the punchline coming, which is that from the standpoint of the future of the country, securities law, let's face it, just doesn't matter as much as constitutional law does. The politically fraught areas, the areas that are going to have a big, big policy impact, are often the same ones that are the most lopsided.
Yeah, not only does it not matter, I guess, in the macro sense, but it's not sexy. It's hard to encourage other people to go into those areas, especially if you want to be trendy. But the
and also, think of it, if you are someone of conservative views and you're dead set on becoming a law professor because you just know you're going to have a better time doing that than any other use of your legal skills, it is very tempting to move into a specialty like securities law, where you know that it's not going to be a career ender for people to find out that you're conservative because its stakes are not high enough. You don't want to move into civil rights law unless you have a particularly pugnacious personality, because there is going to be a lot of scrutiny if you start writing pieces in that area that challenge the conventional wisdom.
Yeah, you say that you made this point about people finding out you're a conservative. I remember when I was in graduate school, somebody came up to me and told me that they were a conservative or a Republican, but they didn't let anybody know. They were in the closet, so to speak. Is that a common phenomenon? Do you have, in these 8 to 1 or 10 to 1 faculty ratios of liberals to conservatives, do you have a certain small minority, or maybe even a plurality, I don't know, of people who are more conservative but just don't want to show it because of this clubby aspect of the faculty that you described?
That is a very common phenomenon, and I know many such people who keep their heads down, and if it's a matter of applying for positions, they know how to sanitize their resume so that the Federal Society mysteriously disappears from it. Not all that easy to sanitize one's resume. One of the key credentials that people tend to get if they're moving into high-end legal academia is a clerkship with a judge. Now, there are a bunch of more or less centrist judges, but it's also well known which judges were appointed by Republicans and which by Democrats, and there's kind of a standing joke that although Supreme Court clerks are in demand in general, it had better not been with Clarence Thomas, or you will have a whole lot of trouble getting in the office from anywhere.
And did that apply at the somewhat lower courts as well? So my friend Brett Kavanaugh, with whom I worked in the White House, if you clerk for him, are you kind of tainted for life?
Well, I don't know specifically about Brett Kavanaugh. I do know that this is one of the things that you can't scrub off your resume. You've got to tell them who you work for, and it does tend to show your cards if there is a strong ideological component, because it's well known that some judges look for that on both left and right. They look for like-minded clerks. So it, you know, it is enough to make the difference for some people in their whether they want to try to hack it in legal academia or just go off and take one of the many other jobs that will be available to someone with good legal credentials.
Yeah, one thing I found interesting in the book is that you talk about people who I guess are with the program to some extent, but then for some reason deviate or become traitors because I guess the hypocrisy is so evident. I mean, you talk about the case of Richard Daynard versus Dickie Scruggs. Can you talk about that case and what it meant?
Well, this goes back to the tobacco litigation, and those who were following the press during the heyday of tobacco litigation will remember that although there were several professors who were quoted a lot, Professor Daynard of Northeastern was constantly quoted in the newspapers, and what he said was, at least to me, very predictable. He was always saying that the tobacco companies were about to be shown, to be, guilty and charged of whatever was being charged in the lawsuit, and that he was predicting victory for the plaintiffs. He was predicting victory for long shot theories, or what other people thought were long shot theories, and there were several strands of litigation, but the biggest one by far was the state Medicaid litigation, which resulted in, depending on how you count, about $248 billion worth of settlements, and an awful lot of money, billions of dollars, went to a small number of lawyers who were representing the states. And the amazing thing that then appeared in the newspapers was that Scruggs had sued Daynard had sued Dickie Scruggs, the best-known of the plaintiff's lawyers, saying that they had a deal where Daynard would share in the contingency fees, which, if successful, would have brought him huge, huge amounts of money. If memory serves, it was hundreds of millions, more than 100 million. What was shocking about this was that the press had just quoted him as being an independent law professor, and it was hard to find. Indeed, you could look through dozens of sites and not find any reference in the press to his being a participant entitled to a percentage share of the litigation, and yet the press might have treated what he had to say much more skeptically had it identified him as such. The Los Angeles Times, which had often quoted him, ran a piece saying that reporters that had talked to couldn't remember his identifying himself as a participant in the litigation as opposed to just a well-wisher based on academic grounds. And it seems to me that there's a line there that often gets fuzzed up, but seldom quite as dramatically fuzzed up as it did in that instance, which is we think of law professors in general when they appear in the media as presumptively disinterested in the stories that they write about. Obviously, they have opinions, but we don't think of them as participants getting money from the litigation, either as hired team members or even more extreme, owning a percentage of the results. And yet this line has been blurred a lot. I'm critical of Vaynard, but he's by no means the only one who has blurred the line. And that means that the authority that law professors bring to the table, which is only partly due to their knowing so much specialized knowledge, it's also because we think of this as academics, just as there was a scandal a few years ago about medical school professors who were too close to drug companies and who would sometimes even let drug companies ghostwrite research reports that they did, which, you know, was jumped on by Congress in hearings. There are instances where law professors get hired supposedly as objective authorities, and there's reason to believe that in some cases they let the law firm ghostwrite their academic opinion on something, which would seem to raise just as many troubling issues as in the medical school context.
Yeah, I love in the Daynard case how you talk about how the Los Angeles Times, based on the article, stopped quoting him for a little while, but then they started quoting him again.
All these newspapers went right back to quoting him as just a law professor as other topics emerged. You know, he was quoted on the effort to turn soft drinks into the next tobacco, which was getting a lot of attention for a while. And even though there was clearly a bunch of contingency fee lawyers involved, no one seems to have gotten him on the record as to whether or not he was a participant or just a well-wisher on that. And the press has a very short memory.
Yeah, one thing that I think is important to discuss as we're sort of getting to the close of the time that you've been so generous to give me is this notion that right now we're facing budget crises at the state, at the local, at the federal level, and there are all kinds of hidden costs that are imposed by lawsuits generally that result from the teachings that the lawyers get at the universities, and then they go out and initiate these lawsuits against the government at whatever level, and it has huge costs for the federal government, the local government, and eventually for taxpayers. One case I thought would have been so amusing if it hadn't been so sad was the New York City anti-homeless program that attracted people that weren't quite so homeless. Can you talk about that one?
In many cases. And here, when we think about the cost of litigation, it's so easy to undercut it because a lot of government expenditures are driven by so-called consent decrees in which some private group, often styling itself as a public interest law group, has sued the city or sued the state saying that you're out of compliance with the law and the only way to comply is for you to promise to spend much more and maybe reorganize the department to provide these new services and so forth. And this is what happened in New York. They entered into litigation, which went on for, I think, at least a decade, in which initially the city thought that it could provide all these services, and then they got more and more expensive, more and more people were taking advantage of them that were not clearly homeless or were not clearly New Yorkers. And you could get a free apartment, you know, set up with restaurant vouchers and furniture by declaring yourself homeless in the right context. And so the expenditures mounted and mounted and mounted and became quite a significant part of the New York City budget. New York was spending tons of money on many other social programs too. But by that point, it was very hard to get out of it. First, there was a very unsympathetic judge, but the way that this whole area of the law has been set up is extremely favorable to the private so-called public interest law firm. The legal fees, to go no further than the legal fees, are set up that heads they win, tails you have to call it even. You know, they win big legal fees if they can prove any of their case, and if you don't get your legal fees paid for, if you're the government, if you are shown not to have done anything wrong. So you wind up with billions and billions, and I traced this out through school finance and other areas, billions and billions and billions of wasteful expenditures driven by litigation in the area of so-called institutional reform litigation, which traces right back to ideas from legal academia. And you could trace it out in areas like medical malpractice, too, where New York City, just to go no further than New York City, is spending vast amounts through its hospital system on suits, many of which are somewhat dubious as far as the scientific reason why a baby is born with birth defects or whatever the theory is. But It is tremendously expensive to taxpayers. It's expensive to anyone who buys insurance for their car, their home, their business. And it's a type of expense that is much, much lesser in most other comparable industrial countries.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that it's not just happening in New York, and it's not just at the local level. But you mentioned the case of the Cincinnati monitor that's costing the city of Cincinnati millions, the California prison health situation that's costing them billions of dollars, and then at the federal level, the Endangered Species Act and Indian claims that literally cost billions and billions of dollars and paralyzed certain parts of the federal government.
And often to the detriment of the supposed point of the program. The example I give in Endangered Species is it is so totally tied up by private litigation, much of which is over the attempt to keep the land from being developed, that the Interior Department has complained at various points that it couldn't get around to listing any new endangered species because all of its resources were tied up on litigation. And that doesn't even make sense from a environmental point of view.
Contrary to the whole point.
And so you've got government that is tied in knots, and there's an interesting division here between views of progressivism and views of liberalism. And I used the opportunity to go back a little bit to FDR's day and to quote at some length. The fact is that many of these same issues were around during that earlier period, and FDR personally and people in his administration could be very eloquent about not tying up the government with endless litigation, about the need to take decisions quickly rather than only after years of wrangling in court, and about the fact that otherwise well-thought-out policies could be tripped up by the, who's got the more clever lawyer or the inevitable chances of litigation. All these lessons somehow were unlearned around the 1960s or 70s, and so we got a system where it's incredibly hard to build a new public project. FDR must be spinning in his grave. That's probably been banned because it might generate turbine energy. We've moved to a completely different kind of liberalism. It's been called litigation liberalism, in which due process is exalted and actually getting the results of the end of the pipeline is deprecated.
Yeah, maybe FDR had a different perspective on these questions because he ended up going to Columbia Law School and not Harvard or Yale, even though he didn't finish law school.
Columbia was generating those ideas too, but he had, as a governor, he had had to get a lot done, and that's probably important in why he got the way he did.
Yeah. Walter, you've been incredibly generous with your time. I'd like to ask you our final signature question here on New Books in Public Policy, which is, if you were czar for a day, what changes would you make based on what you've learned in writing the book to our system?
Well, and of course, the traditional libertarian answer to that is abdicate. If appointed czar, I would abdicate.
Buckley won the New York mayoral race in 65, asked what he would do, he said demand a recount.
Yes. More seriously, although I don't think that I've got definitive answers, I would like to see more variety in the business plans, as it were, of law schools. And I think our accreditation here is something that has really homogenized the law schools. There's a lot of talk about, couldn't we do it in 2 years plus a supervised internship instead of 3 years? Couldn't we, do it in a way that emphasizes the classroom experience and the acquisition of skills that people are going to need in practice? Very often it comes back around to, no, you can't do that because they've set up accreditation and related processes to stamp out competition from some hypothetical law school that would do it that way. So that's one place to look. And there actually is a bit of encouraging news. The ABA and the AALS are both involved in accreditation. The ABA apparently has used this crisis in the legal profession and the economic recession that has been so unprecedented to rethink some of these issues, and is proposed giving law schools more leeway on how to use tenure. They're not telling them that they can't have a tenure for most of their professors, but saying that they're not automatically, or that they're thinking of granting accreditation even to law schools that didn't grant tenure to as many of their professors. And of course, the AALS, which represents the professors individually, just keeled over and had to be revived with smelling salts. Finally, you're getting some real debate about some of the interesting issues of how differently you might set up a law school.
You know, this has really been a groundbreaking podcast because I never thought I would get Walter Olson to come on and praise something that the ABA is doing.
You live long enough and you see.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. You've really been great. I appreciate the time, and I look forward to talking to you when you have your next book.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Walter Olson, the author of Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia, and an Overlawyered America. Olson, who is not a lawyer, seems to be a little freer to criticize the legal profession from his economist's venue. And we really had a good conversation about the huge costs that certain trendy legal theories impose on taxpayers nationwide and even a little bit internationally and increasingly internationally based on what a few elite lawyers are saying at a few top schools. So I think we had a really good talk. It's always fun to have smart authors talk about their books, and this is a very readable, very interesting book. Again, the book was Schools for Misrule. I'm Tebby Troy, the host of New Books for Public Policy. Join us next time for another conversation about an interesting public policy book. And until then, keep reading.